What's poppin', everybody? Hello and welcome to Popcorn Culture. My name is Ben Carlin, and I am your host. Here with me today is my brother Jay, who will be in every episode.
The other host. I'm
not even going to acknowledge it this time. Jay, how are you this week?
Far and wide am I known as the other host of this show. Far and wide.
Near and narrow.
Near and narrow. Oh boy, Ben, I'm doing good.
Are you healthy after all of our horrific Disney tragic?
Not really.
No? You're still
ill? I think
ill?
I basically traded in the flu for a cold.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I woke up this morning, and it was rough. I was, like, stumbling around. I might have been drunk if you just watched me. I was sneezing and coughing, just sort of, like, off the walls, I felt like. Just couldn't quite get it together. I returned to the gym for the first time today in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And we also recorded a Jay versus Ben with our younger brother, Tyler, this morning here at the office. And typically when we do that, we have to get here early because Tyler does it before he goes to work.
Yes.
So, since I've moved, I now live further away from the gym. And if I'm going to get here on time, it requires me to wake up early and get to the gym earlier. And man, I went to bed at like 9 last night or something, real early.
Sure.
And I was still just defeated this morning.
Absolutely defeated.
So defeated.
Oh, this is no good.
No.
This is no good. I hate to hear it. That is the worst. I feel like I'm slowly like coming out of it. I feel like my normal self. I also made it back to the gym this morning, though, just for anybody who's counting at home.
Yeah.
So I imagine somebody
not
literally...
Not as early as me.
But. Not, well, no. You didn't tell me you were going early. I didn't know it was a competition. Otherwise, I would have lost.
This is the easiest way to win all competitions is to not let the other people know they're competing.
Yeah, and then also just never bring it up and like go on living your life knowing that you're winning.
Right.
But nobody's feelings are ever hurt because of it.
That I feel like in a way, well, I don't know if you watch the show Survivor ever, but one of the greatest players ever is a guy named Russell. And I feel like that was sort of his mentality, was that he was playing all these weird mind games with people where they didn't even really know that they were being subject to his game. But the fact that he knew he was winning those games gave him such power over everybody.
Oh, interesting.
It was really, really, I mean, I don't know if you have Survivor fans out there. I love Survivor. It's one of my favorite shows, if not my favorite active TV show.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I know that you and Beth are both big, big Survivor heads. Is there a term for Survivors, like fans of the TV show Survivor?
Boy, you'd think so. I don't know if Survivor head doesn't sound right.
The campers.
Survive. I mean, survivors would be the actual players. I don't know if there's a phrase for Survivor fans at large or like Survivor Nation or something.
It seems like there should be.
Let me tell you, I think it's the 40th season is coming up.
That's so many seasons.
It is so many seasons, and I'm really excited for it because on season 40 of Survivor, which is still coming out and new, they will have all the contestants are ex-winners.
No way.
Your face is like mock enthusiasm.
No, I
can see it.
It's shocking me and all the people driving to work who totally don't have spiders climbing out of their air vents, by the way.
Somebody did.
No!
Someone tweeted me on Twitter and it like just so happened that they did have a spider on their windshield or something.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And we have like ruined driving for them.
Oh, man.
Or
that's,
I guess.
That's not what I was going for, but well, no. I was going to say though that my mock enthusiasm that you interpreted is that was just me like at the same time as all other people listening were also like, no way!
Yeah.
And like I said it like with them, like it in unison, like
right.
Everybody else is also only by themselves, so like they're just there, they didn't know everybody else said it, but surely all around the world right now, individuals at different times all at the same time said no way.
I bet they said it about 30 seconds earlier when I said Survivor is still on the air. No way.
No way.
No way. That's how my son Luke says no way. I go, no way. But then he'll repeat it a bunch because everyone thinks it's hilarious.
It is hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I agree.
I have absolutely, I'm sure that you say it all the time, but I said it around him for the first time, then he said it after me. And I like to take credit for the idea that I taught him no way, but I doubt that I did.
That is a phenomenon that I have started to notice among amongst family members or else other people who interact with your small child.
Oh, is that this is so interesting.
If it's the first time they experience something with your child and it is in response to something they did, everyone, and myself would be included, desperately wants to take credit for having been the one who introduced this thing to the kid.
Oh, no, absolutely. I can tell you 100% that this is a sensation I've had with your son, Luke, where I'm like, yeah, that was me. That was all me right there.
Mm-hmm.
I totally taught him the 3-2-1 run at you and then throw him in the air game.
I think, see, even that one, I want in on this. I feel like you and I were both, because this was outside of Splash Mountain.
It was at Disney World.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was part of that too.
You were there.
I want
you
credit.
Were there.
Yeah. See, even I need credit.
No, of course. Of course.
But
absolutely.
I will describe new things I observed Luke doing to Beth. And she'll be like, oh yeah, I saw him do that last week. And I'm like, oh man.
Oh, it's like a competition.
It's not even intentionally a competition. I don't think anyone's really competing. But certainly people love to speak up and share whenever they think they are the influence.
Like when they made an impact.
Yeah.
This is so funny though, because this is like the want to either introduce a friend to like a podcast or TV show that you like you're their entry point. Teaching somebody about a new favorite band and then them loving it is something people love. But maybe nothing more than anything else is introducing someone to their significant other.
Ooh, it's like someone owes you a favor forever.
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 And like, I feel like in movies and TV shows and stuff, that is how it works. It's like, don't forget that time I introduced you to your wife.
Exactly. Don't forget.
You still owe me for always because of that.
Okay. So let me back up one step down this ladder.
Okay.
Like introducing someone into a new fandom or something. Okay. Have you ever been in this scenario where either you have introduced a friend to something that they began to love or you were introduced to it, but the end result was that the new person to the thing became the bigger fan?
Oh, this has happened to me on multiple occasions, all with the same person.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But not with a fandom, but like with hobbies and activities and stuff.
Okay.
So my friend Steven, who was like my college roommate, he was one of my groomsmen.
Yeah.
We met like in, you know, sixth grade. He is this person who I've like introduced to so many different hobbies. Like I've always referred to him as kind of like a chameleon.
Yeah.
Because he'll just sort of like take on the interests of the people around him. But like when he gets into something, he gets into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you introduced me to rock climbing.
Right.
But then I introduced Steven to rock climbing, who ultimately became the best rock climber out of all of us.
Sure.
I got really into mountain biking and then got him into mountain biking, and then he bought a better bike than me, and then he ultimately ended up working at a bike shop and became a full-time bike commuter. And so like his whole entire, like, you know, he dove so far into it, but also with aquariums. You know, I was super into aquariums. He was graduating a year after me out of college because he switched majors, and his first job out of college was, I was like, dude, come work with me and like we'll be like co-workers and it'll be so fun. Sure enough, he did. He got super into his own reef aquarium at home, and before long his tank was way nicer than mine, and I was like, what gives, man?
So Steven sounds like the ultimate example of like the student becoming the master.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the only solace I've ever been able to take in it is like, oh, but I had to go through all the learning curves on my own. Like,
right.
You benefited from my learning curves.
I pioneered this route and I told you where all the potholes were. So of course it was easier for you.
Exactly.
So does it ever bother you when stuff like this happens, when you have been like ousted of your own hobby? Or
I think in the beginning it did. Mm-hmm. It was the type of thing, like, especially because I think for so much of my life I have tied an enormous amount of my identity to my hobbies.
Right.
Like those, you know, when you ask people like, oh, like what do you do, it's like when you meet somebody for the first time, it's like, oh, this is my friend Bill, he's an engineer.
Yeah.
Like you assign part of like such a huge part of their identity is their job.
Yeah.
For me, I feel like it was always like, yeah, I'm like into, you know, like outdoorsy stuff. Like I like biking, kayaking, fishing, you know, like hiking, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
And so I think in the beginning, it was definitely one of those things where if it was something that brought me confidence, I am competitive enough that if someone that I'm super close with also got really good at it, then it like maybe kind of took away from my personal enjoyment of it, because like I was no longer the best at it,
right?
Amongst my inner circle, at least. Like, I've always been more than willing to accept that I am absolutely 100% not even the best at anything, like in Roanoke,
sure,
let alone, you know, at large.
At large.
But yeah, no, I think that that is definitely something that has given me moments of pause where I'm like, who am I? What is even the point? And I think this exact phenomenon happened when I started dating Alice.
Oh, really?
Where, like, her whole life, she has been this, like, diehard Harry Potter fan.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
She's mm-hmm. literally born on July 31st. Like, she shares a birthday with J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter.
Right.
Like, she grew up with it just the same way that we did. You know, she would get the book, she would read them in the first day. But, like, when we first started talking, I remember she was, like, throwing her annual Harry Potter party, like, which we weren't even close enough friends to where I would have, like, gone to that first party yet.
Right.
But that was, like, the type of thing that, like, one of the very first bits of information that I knew about who she was that she threw an annual Harry Potter party.
Right. This seems like a good sign.
Yeah, right. Like, it's amazing. But then the more that we dated, the more that she started, like, listening to me coming home and talking about video topics for Super Carlin Brothers, the more she seemed to like shrink back little by little by little, where like all of a sudden like she didn't even want to like listen to the Harry Potter audiobooks with me, or like she wouldn't want to like watch the movies with me or something. It was like I literally took all of the identity that she attached to Harry Potter, and because mine was just so, because of my job,
right,
like so much like more prominent, so much more relevant,
right,
I think that she just like forgot how to allow that to be something that made her unique.
But see, so it sounds like, and I don't want to speak for your wife now or anything, it sounds like she must have taken a certain amount of pride in that of all of her friends who were Harry Potter fans, she was, in her mind, like...
The ringleader.
The ringleader, the one who was throwing the parties, the one who had read the book so many times. Little did she know, you were just waiting around the corner like, oh, you think you know Harry Potter.
Little did she know.
Little did she know. I've written papers on Little Did She Know.
Oh my gosh. Stranger than Fiction. Great movie. Oh,
great movie if you haven't read if you haven't read it. If you haven't seen it.
Yes, yes. So no, I think that's exactly what happened. And I've even talked to her about it. And I think that like at first, this realization was something that like, I think deep down she knew was true, but like she had like a hard time ultimately like maybe coming to terms like, this is what happened. Like, something happened. I started dating this guy who's super into Harry Potter, and somehow I became less into Harry Potter as a result.
That's very interesting.
This is going to be my question that I would like to throw out to all listeners today, is whether or not you have ever had this happen where your interest squashed someone else's interest.
Right.
Maybe squashed isn't the right word, because that sounds like somewhat malicious.
Where you were introduced to something by a friend and subsequently became a greater fan of that thing and ruined it for them.
Right. Or alternatively. The other way around.
Yes.
That you introduced something to one of your friends and then they took it so much further than you had ever thought to take it.
Which is, it's so weird, because you would think that if you introduced someone to something and they got like on your level or even above you in terms of like how much they seemed to care about a thing or knew about a thing, that you would just celebrate it together.
You would think. That is the exact expectation that I would have under all circumstances, that like, but this happens all the time, like where I think even you and Beth have said it before, where you guys will meet a friend from church or something and you'd be like, oh my gosh, Ben, you would love him. Like, he's super into mountain biking, loves rock climbing. And I'm like, I don't want to be friends with me, okay? Like, you know, the last thing I need is another me in my life. I'm enough me.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And it is such a weird thing, because there are certainly personality types out there who, like, when they meet someone similar to them, it's the best thing ever, and vice versa, where if you meet some, where there are people who, if you meet someone who has too many of your shared interests, you don't want that at all, because all of a sudden you don't stand out as much.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think so much of that is this, like just sort of sense of individualism that mm-hmm. we have, like, in today's society, is sort of, like, who you are as a unique snowflake is so important, but maybe it's something that we need to like overcome.
Well, I just watched over the weekend on your recommendation a movie called Blinded by the Light.
Yes,
which if you're unfamiliar with it, or maybe you, I'm sure you saw the previews, but it is a movie that takes place in the late 80s in like Luton in England.
Which
England. It takes place in the late 80s in England, and it follows a Pakistani teenager.
I would say small town England.
Small town England.
It must be what it is. It's like the type of town where like everyone might work at like a factory or something like that. Like it seems like that's where his dad worked.
Right. It's where his dad worked, and he's feeling very frustrated with the culture of his heritage and his family because he is Pakistani and he wants to escape small town England.
Yes.
And his avenue out, the thing that gives him so much life, is when a new friend introduces him to the music of Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
And the whole movie, I don't think I could place it until just about now. Him and his friend just like geek out over Springsteen the whole time.
Yes.
And the whole time, part of me is like, man, if I was that friend, I'd be kind of annoyed that it seems like this new guy is like swooping in on my thing. They are not. They just love it together the whole time.
If anything, it amplifies.
It amplifies, which is how it should work.
It is.
It is.
I 100% agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. That's interesting. I think it's interesting that this conversation topic has come up because I think that was something that was floating in the back of my mind as I was watching the movie where I couldn't quite place it.
Sure.
Because it seemed like, maybe, and I'm sure it's just part of the movie, but the new friend who's just learning about Springsteen seems like he's suddenly the ringleader of the group of friends. Who are all now Springsteen fans, but he was not the one, but he was introduced to Springsteen by someone else in the group.
Right, and sort of hesitantly takes a listen after like the tapes fall out of his jacket.
Right.
When he gets home. Like, it's not even like he immediately takes to it.
Yeah.
So, anyway, if you've ever had an experience like this with one of your friends, I want to know your whole story. You can email us at popcornculturepod@gmail.com, which, by the way, we got tons of feedback on our Disney Magic versus Disney Tragic conversation from last week's episode, which thank you guys so much. We were inundated with emails from people reaching out and telling us their stories, which, by the way, is the most heartwarming thing ever.
Or heartbreaking.
But the fascinating thing, even about the heartbreaking stories, was that, like, very few of them were they circumstances where, like, Disney parks or cast members were the reason or at fault. It was, like, almost under all circumstances, an outside situation that like, unfortunately...
Right, like what insurance companies would call an act of God.
Right. Exactly, yeah. Or something that just, like, prevented them from getting there or cease their enjoyment,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the experience. One of the stories that somebody told that I thought was like, so I felt for them so bad, but it was so simple, was that they were out in California for Disneyland and they had rented a car, and the morning that they were going, like, to, you know, get in the car to go out to Disneyland,
right,
it was gone.
The car was gone. Someone stole their rental car?
Rental car. And so now all of a sudden, you're just like, they like walk out the door, you know, it's like 6 o'clock in the morning, they're like ready to go hit the parks, and their car is gone. And like, they have the keys, and so, you know, like they say in their email that they're like, you know, looking for a sign that like it had been towed, like, you know, we were staying, you know, like on like a property that we're not familiar with, maybe this was like not a parking zone or something, and then like, the car was taken away, no indication of anything like that. And so, like, what is going on? So they ultimately have to, you know, like, go and report it. They have to go and find a way to, you know, like, do the police report. They have to get to the airport. They have to do all these things. And before long, you know, you're talking about like hours where all the companies involved were cooperative and they understand, like, they obviously still have the keys, you know, like they were upgraded cars even.
Sure.
But unfortunately, like, their Disney experience was completely slashed by the fact that their rental car was stolen.
Oh, I can't tell you how frustrating that would be. Although it does, I don't know if we've even told this story on the pop already. It reminds me of the time where you and I were going to Disney and Beth and I were flying and you were driving, and we got down there and it wasn't that our hotel room was stolen. I'm not sure that can happen. It was just that...
That would be an odd problem.
It was just that it had actually been booked for the night before through a total clerical error on your end.
On my part, yeah. Yeah.
Boy, I feel like I don't think I've ever had such... I don't know. That seems like your worst Disney tragic. I don't know.
Well, I think that probably would have to be up there. There was... That whole trip was strange. change, and I think it was such a huge indicator that, like, Alice was, like, the person that I was meant to be with, because things went wrong constantly throughout the entirety of the trip, and it was just, like, it like you just kind of, like, were on the ground, like, crying, and, like, the world kept kicking you, and except you're in this magical place where everything is perfect, and you're smiling anyway with your Mickey ears on, you know, eating your churro, but... Yeah, no, that was pretty bad. We were driving down with the camper. It was like the first like real major trip that I had taken it on and decided that a 14-hour journey by car was the best way to do it. And I don't know if you've ever pulled anything before, but pulling a, you know, 7,000-pound trailer is exhausting. So anyway, I was just exhausted. We had booked two nights because we planned for it to take us two full nights to get down to Disney World. And I think what had happened was I booked the hotel room for the first night, you know, like Thursday night, the 18th or whatever. And then I'm going to book the Friday night one. And in my head, I'm like, yeah, I need Thursday night, the 18th. So I just happened to book the same one twice. But even once we were down there, I locked my keys inside the camper.
Right. Oh, like, which shouldn't be possible.
It shouldn't be possible because the only way that a camper can lock is from the outside with the key.
Right.
So it's like, I was so adamantly convinced, you know, and like, this is, you know, you're out there, like, I've already been kind of stressed out because of this camper and stuff. And we go to open the door and Allie and I are both standing out there and we're like, it's locked. And I was so sure that this could not happen, that my actual primary concern was somebody was in my camper.
Right.
Like, I was like, that is what has to have happened.
But you still don't know what happened.
I still don't know what happened. Maybe the guy's still in there. Like,
you have a live-in.
Can you imagine?
I cannot. Oh. I cannot, because it's been like over a year now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been some time.
And you've used it again.
Yep, certainly.
And certainly you got back in the camper.
Yep.
So I don't think anyone's living in
it. Okay, there. Okay. Good to know. Thank you for that assurance.
I'll clear your conscience there for you, hopefully. My goodness. Man, Disney tragic. Okay, speaking of tragedies, I think we have some Academy Award things we need to talk about. I see you've put some Academy Award stuff into the notes for today.
Yeah, just hard left turn into the Academy Award.
Hard left turn. The tragedy I want to talk about right out of the gate is that on the Best Animated Features nominees, one Frozen 2 was not even nominated.
Oh,
I don't understand.
An abominable snowman if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, but seriously.
So tell me more about how you feel about this. Because to me, so I haven't seen everything. Things that I did see on there that I thought were, that should be on there, is How to Train Your Dragon 3.
Sure.
Great movie. Klaus, yes. Which was like, I would have lobbied for so hard. I 100% think needs to win.
Yeah.
Toy Story 4.
Yep.
And then there are, I believe, two Netflix movies.
There are, I haven't seen either of these others two. One's called I Lost My Body and one's called Missing Link.
Oh, Missing Link is actually the one about, I think it's like a claymation style movie. It almost in the style of like Chicken Run.
Oh, yes. That wasn't a Netflix movie though.
I don't think that one was. Okay. That one I think was just a mainstream movie.
Okay.
So to me, I don't know enough about Missing Link, or what was the other one called? I'm sorry.
I Lost My Body.
I Lost My Body. So I can't speak for those. To me, I think the weakness or the weak point out of everything else that I have seen has got to be Toy Story 4. So my argument for the purposes of our conversation, not having seen two of these movies, is does Toy Story 4, should Toy Story 4 win out over Frozen 2? Go.
No, it shouldn't. The thing is, I'm with you. Of these movies, I think Klaus should win either way, even if Frozen 2 was nominated, because Klaus was awesome.
I think Klaus is amazing for a variety of reasons. For one, it's not a sequel.
Right.
Which I think, like, immediately just, I think, gives me a little bit more. It is a remarkably original story.
I would say, because...
a Christmas movie.
Yes.
No less.
Yes.
Which is, like, to me, I think, in the way in which they developed what felt like a completely brand new Christmas story that does not feel ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, the way that they come to the conclusions, the way that they, like, established all of the different rituals that ultimately became the Christmas as we know it, with Santa Claus coming down the chimney and leaving a toy under the tree. Like, the whole thing, how a postman effectively invented Christmas.
Right.
Is, I don't know. I love the movie. I have watched it. It is one of the few movies that I saw in 2019 where I saw it and was like, I can't wait to watch it again.
Oh.
Like, and I have then since watched it at least, I have watched it at least three times, if not four.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you watched it since Christmas?
I have.
Wow.
I have watched it after Christmas.
Man, so Klaus has got a big vote for you.
Yes.
And I would say I agree with everything you said. I thought Klaus was awesome. If you haven't seen it on Netflix, check it out. But, and so I still think it should win. I still think it was better than Frozen 2. But it is blowing my mind that Frozen 2 didn't get nominated for animated feature. And I just want to complain about it here on The Pop. Because I want to say last year or maybe the year before, but like Boss Baby got nominated for Best Feature.
No, it didn't. Well,
yeah, like I'm sorry. No, no.
The Secret Life of Pets didn't, though, did it?
Not. I think it might have.
Hold on. I have to see if The Secret Life of Pets, because The Secret Life of Pets is my version. Like you don't like Minions at all.
No. Not really.
And okay, I'm not seeing anything for The Secret Life of Pets, which is perfect in my opinion, because I genuinely think that, well, I think that me and you both have like animated movies that frustrate us.
Yeah.
That like are our baseline for like movie that we disagree with at their core. And I know for you, it's I don't even think it's Despicable Me, because I feel like you like Despicable Me.
No, I like Despicable Me. Despicable Me is great because, and God, it's Illumination has done the thing. That Illumination is the studio that produces Despicable Me.
Yes.
And The Secret Life of Pets, for what it's worth. But they have totally done the thing where the Minions were like an adorable section of Despicable Me, and they have let the Minions take over.
Yes.
They have like, oh, they have done like the Cars 2 thing where they gave Mater his own movie, but instead they have just let the Minions take over to the point where it's just, it's like Minion mania, and they're so annoying, and it's like, yeah, they were funny in Despicable Me, but like, let them be the little side characters that are adorable and put them on the marketing or whatever. Do not let them be the main thing. Like, Gru has to be the main thing, or the Minions are not, they don't stand on their own.
Sure.
That's where
sure.
I'm at.
Well, and this would be like Olaf, I think, is in the exact same position, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, Olaf shows up pretty far into the original Frozen. Like, it's, I think you're 40 minutes into the movie before he's even introduced at all.
Well, they introduce him very briefly when Anna and Elsa are little girls. And they're like, sure. I'm Olaf, I like warm hugs.
Of course, yes. That's a great moment, though.
It is. But see, that's one of those little tiny nuggets you need so that when Olaf shows up later, you're like, oh, from when they were kids.
Yeah, so that's exactly how, and then I think in Frozen 2, I was very, very, very worried that they were going to have Olaf go over the top and be like too center stage, and they didn't, and Olaf was great and amazing, and like he totally, in my opinion, was like one of the best parts of Frozen 2, other than the music, which is so spectacular, mm-hmm. it's not even funny. But they were nominated for Best Original Song.
They were with Into the Unknown.
Into the Unknown.
Okay. What's baffling to me, though, about Frozen 2's snub is like when you have things like Boss Baby getting in to this category, is that the original Frozen, when it came out in 2013, was nominated for an Oscar, and not for Best Animated Feature, just for straight up Best Film.
Frozen was nominated for Best Film.
Yes, Frozen was nominated just for straight up Best Film, not Best Animated.
Okay.
And somehow, Frozen 2, which has upped the anime, like, I don't know what they're voting on for Best Animation in the Oscars department, if they're voting on, like, the quality of the animation or the overall, like, story of the movie. It's so weird with animation because anything is possible with animation. What are you judging it on to make it in?
I think it's the whole film. As a movie, as a story, as everything that goes into it, and probably not as much the pixels, because it is Best Animated Feature,
mm-hmm.
Which to me is different from the Academy Award for Best Animation.
Which there should almost also be.
Yes. Okay. I think that is the best argument, right. Is that there needs to be a category for just Best Animation, period.
Right.
Because I do think that that's a huge category that gets blown wide open, you know,
yeah.
Like, because there are so many different areas where that can be achieved. But even that as a whole, so like sort of going back to Frozen being nominated for Best Picture, one of the big conversations that like I teeter on all the time, and I have no idea, I was like fearful that this would be like a controversial question to put out there, but it's sort of the topic of, should there be an Academy Award for like blockbuster style films that maybe don't fall into that category of like best film? Like Avengers Endgame was a worldwide like phenomenon,
right?
And you know, surpassed Avatar, which also true, but also won many Academy Awards.
Yeah.
James Cameron's Avatar. That is what was previously holding the title for most, you know,
most successful at the box office.
Most successful at box office. Yes, exactly. And so my question is, should there be a space for movies like Avengers Endgame, where you're talking about like super, super mass appeal films that don't net, like typically at best, I feel like films like that end up in like best editing or best sound effects or something like that. You know,
Avengers
like
Endgame is nominated for one Academy Award right now for the upcoming award show, and it is in visual effects.
Visual effects. Okay. Yep. Yes. So yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, I don't know how I feel about the idea of such a movie that made such an impact on you know the planet, in that, you know, roughly 280 million people went to see it.
Right.
Like, what does that say for its mark in cinematic history as it pertains to what I believe most people to consider the highest honor you can receive in trophy form?
Meaning the Academy Awards.
Meaning right. the Academy
so,
Awards.
So, yeah, like, it sounds like your question boiled down is, is it a problem that the most successful box office movie of all time is not even a nominee for Best Picture of the year it came out in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
It's and it is unusual, because it seems like historically, perhaps maybe back around like the 90s or early 2000s, that very often the most successful movies were also the most critically acclaimed movies.
Yes.
And it seems like maybe the relationship was very parallel at one time, where because movies were well critically received, people went and saw them more.
Right.
Right, which makes sense. Whereas you've almost reached a like new, I don't know, era of movies where the critical reception and the audience reception has deviated so much to the point where it feels like critics almost don't want the most successful movies to be critically the best at the same time.
Right, you right, know? Yeah.
It, financial success hurts your critical receptiveness.
Right. And I think that, like, when it boils down to it, it's like since 2010, which is not that long a period of time, but no movie that has won the award Best Picture has been a top 10 movie at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that that is a problem or a crime or absolutely anything of the sort. Mm-hmm. You know, I do think there's something to be said for the idea that, like, when you're watching the Academy Awards, like, I know for me this year, I saw the nominations for Best Picture, and I talked to Alice, and I'm like, I want to see all of them,
right?
So that, like, when we're inevitably watching the Oscars, I can actually like care,
yeah,
if that makes sense,
yeah.
Because I do think that that frequently happens to me, where it's like, I really want to watch the Oscars because it's like, you know, this big thing, and we talk about movies for a living. You know, it's relevant to our lives. But frequently I've seen so few of the movies that are up for contention,
yeah,
that I feel almost a little left out.
I feel like that must, and I don't know, maybe this is just us, but I would feel that that's probably a very shared frustration amongst the, like, the general public, is that the Oscars is, like it or not, the like most prestigious award in film, and it's probably the most watched award show of all of them.
Absolutely.
Period. And like, what wins feels like it matters a little bit more, but it can be very frustrating to watch, because so often as you're watching, like, maybe not only have you not seen all of the movies, but there are years where I feel like I haven't even heard of half of the nominations.
Right.
All of a sudden. And you just feel, well, yeah, kind of like left out. Like, these are movies. Like, movies tend to, like, define pop culture. And as someone who sees a lot of movies, you would think you would be able to watch with some amount of understanding.
Right. Like, and I think what it comes down to, and I'm sure that this is not that like the case at all, and it's more of a Ben problem than a world problem, but like I frequently feel like I'm maybe not smart enough to enjoy the Academy Awards.
Mm.
Because I go and watch blockbuster movies as like my primary means of theater consumption.
Uh-huh.
Opposed to what I might like rent once it's available. So I don't know, like I frequently feel like I'm like watching so many more artistic and talented and intelligent people who understand why these movies that didn't make it in front of my eyes are so spectacular.
Right.
And so the big question for me truly at the end of the day is not so much my own personal complex, but even just, should there be a category that is specifically for movies like that to even maybe allow the people like us in the world that like, that is our favorite kind of movie and objectively shared by lots of other people in that these movies tend to make a lot more money at the box office.
Right. And I mean, there's so many layers to the question because you have to suddenly define what it means to be a blockbuster movie.
And that's
that,
true.
Does that come down to like the amount of dollars spent to produce the movie or to market the movie or something like that? And if, whatever arbitrary number you decide for this, like if you decide, okay, a blockbuster movie is anything that costs more than $100 million to make, then inevitably what you're going to get is the category of movies that have spent $1 less.
Oh, sure.
Sure. Because like winning the Oscars is not as simple as just you put the movie in theaters and then people voted.
Right.
There's a lot of prestige and I want to say money that comes along with winning. And like even just the process of marketing your movie specifically to the Academy involves throwing lots of parties and trying to garner votes. And like the campaigning for your movie just to win, like there's so much money that goes into that.
Sure. It's a whole wrung out thing. And maybe that's even where people would argue that the politics of everything ruins it inevitably. And that there's too much of a committee problem. I think we were talking to even Scott before we popped in here to record this episode. And he was saying that he thinks like part of the problem is that, I don't even know if this is the terminology he would use. I'm going to paraphrase Scott as to not put words in his mouth, but safer movies might ultimately end up winning because there might be some polarization that happens where people feel super passionately that this movie is either the best or the worst.
Right.
So like movies that people have like much, much, much stronger feelings about end up canceling each other out, whereas movies that end up maybe having like a generally more acceptable message to all voting members will kind of emerge to the top. So maybe it's nobody's best, but it was like third place for everyone. But movies that were people's ones and twos might be other people's, nines and tens.
Right.
And so as a result, they both get pulled out of the running, and mm-hmm. that third place movie that like dodged all the, extraneous fire sort of floats right to the surface. So even then you have to wonder, like, does the movie that wins ever feel like is the general consensus ever everybody being like, yeah, that's exactly what should have won?
Right.
Like, that movie deserved.
Well, I don't think if you're holding out for universal popularity in
I am,
the
Jay.
Choice.
I'm
you
holding
are,
out for you. I want it to be like a movie is so, I want to watch that movie.
Right.
The movie that is so good that everyone agrees that it needed to win.
Okay. So when I feel like that movie's already happened, first of all. Like if you look at the complete list of every Best Picture Oscar winner ever, are there any where you, and I don't know, maybe you haven't looked at it, where you think, yeah, obviously. Because to me, the movie, there are a few. The 90s, I feel like, was really good. I feel like was the peak time for the movie being critically popular and also commercially popular, where everyone must have just straight up agreed this is what should have won.
Okay.
But to me, the ultimate representation of everyone agreed this should have won, it's an awesome movie, is Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. It should have won.
1995. I don't know what the other nominees were that year, but I can hardly believe anyone would have thought anything except Forrest Gump could have even won.
Yep. No, I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Also, I would bet 1998's winner, Titanic, went unscathed in the first place.
People not being upset about that one.
I don't think anyone was upset. I would bet very few people were upset by Forrest Gump or Titanic winning the Oscars.
Okay, what year did Jurassic Park come out?
I don't know.
What would Jurassic Park have been up against? Oh, okay, so it lost to Schindler's List.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. I would argue Schindler's List is amazing and that deserved to win, but like that is such a situation where Jurassic Park is so screwed because it was up against such a strong candidate to beat it.
Right.
But, like probably would have won the year prior. The year after it would have lost to Forrest Gump.
What
so.
Won before Schindler's List?
Unforgiven.
I never heard of it.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you're right. Jurassic Park, fun dinosaur movie about things going wrong in a theme park, really stood no chance against super important movie about the Holocaust.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I understand why it wouldn't have won there. But, oh yeah, I don't know. It's so good. It's so funny to me that that's even the movie that I was like, I need to see who it lost to.
Right.
Because I couldn't even told you 100% fact that it was nominated, but I was also like, who did it lose to?
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere in my brain space, it must have known that no matter what, it was in the contention. Mm-hmm. So anyway, moving on from that, though, you were talking a little bit about sort of the like all the lobbying and everything that goes into making an Academy Award happen, all the parties and all that. Do you want to know what's kind of fascinating about the statue itself?
What is that?
It is only worth $1.
The statue is only worth $1?
The golden statue is only worth $1.
Well, that doesn't sound... That sounds like there must be something to it.
Ask
because it's
question.
Made of gold.
Ask me the... It's okay,
is
hold
it made,
on.
Okay, first of all, is it made of gold? Because I feel like that much gold is worth more than a dollar.
My Google search says that the statuettes are solid bronze and plated in 24 karat gold.
Okay, that much bronze seems like it's worth more than a dollar, though.
Sure. Due to a metal shortage during World War II, Oscars were made of painted plaster for 3 years. Mm. Following the war, the Academy invited recipients to redeem their plaster figures for gold-plated metal ones. So a little bit of history there, going back to the 1940s. How about that?
Very nice.
Okay, so the reason why Oscars are only worth $1 is because one of the like rules when you are like signing up for being nominated for an Oscar is that if you win it and you decide you do not want your statue anymore, you are signing that you will give the Academy the right to purchase it from you for $1
first. Okay.
And so under any and all circumstances, mostly, there would not be a circumstance where the Academy would go back on this incredibly strict rule that they have created.
So I wonder what the rules are if you accept it and then you die and bequeath the statue onto someone else, and then can they sell it, or are they still obligated
they
under
the
contract?
They are still bound.
Wow.
It literally says this also applies to family members who inherit Oscars from relatives who have died.
Okay, so now here's the question then, because you could say that makes it worth a dollar, but what is the fine for not selling it to the Academy?
Oh, well, that's the thing, though, is that you can't. Literally, somebody tried to sell it back in 1989, and the Academy stepped in and took their statue back, and they won the lawsuit.
Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
So I did read of one occasion pre-1950 where someone had won the award, and I believe in 1950 circa is when they created the stipulation. There was one situation where a guy had won the Academy Award for, I think, like Best Actor or something, and his wife got desperately ill.
Mm-hmm.
And he ultimately later ended up selling his award to like raise the medical funds.
Oh.
And there was some question as to whether or not he could do that, and he basically declared up and down, left, right, sideways, you know, whatever, that he never signed anything agreeing to that. So even though the rule existed after he had done it, I think there have been two occasions where Academy Awards have been successfully sold.
Man, I wonder how much he got for it.
I believe it was about $100,000 in modern day money.
Okay.
And then another one was sold for as much as, in modern day money, approximately $1 million.
Interesting.
Yes.
Wow.
So that's kind of crazy. The other thing that I thought was sort of fascinating about the Oscar statue is that he is holding a crusader's sword. So the guy standing there is actually holding a sword, which okay. is something I had never specifically noticed before. And he is standing on a reel of film with five spokes, signifying the original branches of the academies, actors, directors, producers, technicians, and writers.
Ah, there you
which
go.
Which is kind of interesting,
so those
right?
are like the original five awards?
I don't know if those are the... I think even on the original Academy Awards, there were 16 or 17 statues that were handed out.
Okay.
But there was also the other kind of fascinating thing about it is like we always use the terms the Academy Awards and the Oscars sort of like interchangeably.
Right.
Why is it called the Oscars?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, I have the answer.
Oh, great.
I set you up so nicely.
You did.
Thank you for that. Actually, it sounds like it's a rather contested thing, but the what Wikipedia was basically saying as the more commonly accepted version of this story is that a woman by the name of Margaret Herrick, who was the executive secretary for the Academy, said that when she first saw the award in 1931, that the statuette reminded her of her uncle Oscar.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That's why they're called the Oscars.
It was a nickname for her actual cousin, Oscar Pierce.
That seems so weird to me that the Academy would allow the name to stick.
Oh, I know.
That they wouldn't be like forcing, at the very least, because it's on whatever network it's on. I think it's on ABC most of the time. I don't know. Whatever network it's on, it seems to me that if I was the Academy Awards, I would demand that all of the reporters and all of the on-air talent refer to it only as the Academy Awards.
Right, instead of like, calling it the Oscars.
So at this point, to me, the fact that they don't do that, because I feel quite certain that if you turn on, they'll talk about the Oscars. Even the nominees, even the people, the presenters would be like, and the Oscar goes to...
Oh yeah,
you know, like, no, they'll call it that.
It has become ubiquitous,
right?
As a 100% accepted term.
I would. I am curious to know if they own like some sort of trademark on it
over the name.
Now.
I'm sure that they do now. What I thought was more interesting, so even if we want to question the legitimacy of this particular anecdote, is that one way or another, the best explanations that were at least on the Wikipedia article were entirely anecdotal.
Oh.
So it's like, if it's not this one, it's another person who said it looked like an Oscar.
Gotcha.
Of some type. Like it was not some type of like profound, like OSCAR doesn't stand for outstanding source of charismatic actor rhubarb. Rhubarb is like celery but red, and somehow it's made into pies. I've never understood how, like, celery pie to me seems like the most horrifyingly upsetting idea ever.
I think rhubarb probably has a little more flavor than celery.
Okay, but it looks the same, only red.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I think it's more of a European thing than an American thing.
Maybe. I guess oranges also look like grapefruits, and they don't taste the same either.
They sure don't.
Oranges greater than grapefruits.
No question about it, Ben. Okay. Grapefruits are the worst fruits.
Strong opinions about things that don't matter.
Grapefruit. I have many opinions. First of all, it's like, it feels like it's so badly grapes, like high school bully. It's like, oh, hey, grape, I'm grapefruit. You're a fruit who's a grape. I'm grapefruit.
So you find grapefruit as an entity to
look
to...
Big grapefruit couldn't come up with its own name. Like, and it was like, oh, how did it get called grapefruit? When like, grapes exist.
And not like sour orange.
And not like terrible tasting orange or pink on the inside or something. An equally creative name for grapefruit.
Grapefruit as a name makes as much sense as why the Oscars are called Oscars.
Right. Like, I wish, man, just call, even if I was grapes, I would just call myself, I don't know, like wine fruit or something. Wine fruit sounds fun.
Wine fruit sounds fun, but it does not sound as sweet as a grape tastes.
That's true. No, grapefruit needs a whole new name. Okay, we're gonna come up with a new name for grapefruit because it has stepped on grape for far too long.
It has basically turned grape into wine.
At this point. Yeah, grapefruit. Maybe, I wonder if that's it. If people were like, people love grapes. You turn grapes into wine. We'll just call this grapefruit and people will get it confused, except they can't get it. Oh, it's just, gosh, grapefruits, first of all, their name is stupid, and second of all, they taste terrible.
Hold on, what is the origin of grapefruit. I'm looking this up right now. The name. Let's just see. I'm reading blind right now. This is me not even knowing where I'm going.
We don't know where this is going.
Grapefruit is a citrus hybrid originating in Barbados as an accidental cross between two introduced species.
To the surprise of no one, grapefruits were an accident.
Sweet. Sweet orange and pomelo, or shaddock, both of which were introduced from Asia in the 17th century. When found, it was nicknamed the forbidden fruit.
The forbidden fruit? That's already apple, okay?
The forbidden fruit.
The forbidden fruit is already an apple. So this is, now it's going into like grape apple fruit. Anyway, go on.
Let's see here. I'm trying to see. I want to know why it's actually called like grapefruit. The name grapefruit seems to originate with the way that, unlike normal citrus, the fruits of this tree grow in clusters, vaguely reminiscent of bunches of grapes.
Yeah, but that's no reason to call it grapefruit.
It's not.
Grapes are already fruits.
Okay. It doesn't sell me on the name at all.
Yeah.
But that is better than I expected.
I will give it better than expected, but it's no excuse. It's, first of all, a combination of an orange and a pomelo that was already tried to steal Apple's glory as the forbidden fruit, and instead is now stepping all over the fruit grape because it grows in the same way. Like, it's even the fact that it's because it grows in the same way, it's named after a different fruit. Like, it just... gosh, it doesn't even taste good, Ben.
It doesn't even taste good.
Has someone ever given you just like a glass of grapefruit juice?
Yes.
Yeah, and you're like, huh, well, the fruit's terrible, but maybe as a juice.
The fruit, as a rule, obviously terrible.
Maybe as a juice, they've done something to make it. And you sip it, and you're like, oh, you know what this tastes like? Grapefruits.
So, okay, what would your relationship be then with wine, which is made from grapes, but of course does not taste like grapes?
Yeah, wine's amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, okay. So your issue with grapefruit is that it tastes exactly like it's
My issue with grapefruit juice is that it tastes like grapefruits. And my issue with grapefruits is that it tastes like grapefruits. Oh my gosh. People are gonna argue tooth and nail that grapefruits taste good. And let me just tell you right now, no, they don't. Maybe if you're putting sugar on them, they're acceptable in some capacity. But let me tell you what you're actually tasting there is sugar. And sugar is, of course, amazing.
Do you want to know what doesn't need sugar added to it to make it everybody's favorite?
Grapes?
Reese's.
Reese? Oh, hard. Ben's pivoting me away from grapefruits.
I know. He's got like actual steam coming out of his ears right now. So.
Okay, let's. Let's go back to the movies with our movie candy, because we have a lot of follow-up from the last pop.
Oh, yes. Jordan, our office manager, or as we like to call her, the Jane of all trades in our office here, has put together actual graphs that tell us how much you guys, the listening audience, enjoy specific candies, and they are broken down in an unbelievably remarkable manner here.
Yeah. We've got some good data.
We have some really good data. The most popular candy, I believe, well, actually, I don't know. We have red bars and blue bars here.
Okay. I'm looking at the same sheet you are.
Okay.
And the title of this graph is favorite and perceived favorite candies.
Oh, I see. So, okay.
The red bar is, I believe, actually, gosh, I need to double check before I start saying things. Let me look. Oh, gosh. My Slack is going crazy. Okay. On our chart, the blue is the favorite and red is the perceived favorite. So what we were looking for, we were kind of looking for both answers. The perceived, we said in our last podcast, in the last pop, that our perceived three favorite candies of in America were Reese's Cups, Snickers, and peanut M&Ms.
Yes.
But that was inaccurate according to our survey data. In fact, the perceived favorite candies by most people are Reese's, Snickers, and regular M&Ms.
Regular M&Ms. Plain.
However, then, this is just our own survey data, the actual favorite candy, despite the perception, is that the real favorite candies are Reese's, peanut M&Ms, and Kit Kats.
Kit Kat
came in third with Snickers at a very close fourth.
And for those of you at home who want to know what we're looking at, we will have these graphs in our show notes for today's episode. So be sure to go and check those out. Jordan did a fantastic job of putting these together. So how do you, I mean, I don't really take issue with the idea that Reese's are both perceived to be the best, and most people seem to, or their personal preference would indicate that Reese's is their favorite candy.
There are a couple really interesting comparisons, because many of the red and blue bars are pretty close.
Okay.
So, yes, it is no surprise to me that Reese's are the perceived favorite and the actual favorite candy.
Okay.
At all. Like, everyone loves a Reese's.
My favorite way to eat a Reese's is chilled.
Oh, really?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. By like a mile. Because, so I don't know what it is, but like at room temperature, Reese's cups are like the complete opposite of M&M's, like melt in your mouth, not in your hand.
Yeah.
Right? Reese's at room temperature are actively melting.
Right, okay.
Like, especially like if you go to peel it off of like the little tray.
Yeah.
Like if it leaves some of its bottom, if it has a soggy bottom and leaves some of it on the paper,
that's no good.
I'm so disappointed.
So disappointed.
I'm so disappointed. So like what I would prefer to have is to have them chilled, and then when you take them away, perfect breakage.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So my favorite way to eat a Reese's I don't do it as much anymore because it seems like it gets a little messier for the aforementioned melting reasons.
Yes.
But I used to punch out the middle.
Oh, you did?
I would punch the middle out because there's a soft middle and there's a hard ring.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would punch it out and I would eat the middle and then I would eat the ring. So I'm curious to know if other people have other ways they eat Reese's. Maybe people bite into them like crazy people.
Like crazy
just
people.
Just straight at room temperature.
Goodness me.
Eat a grapefruit.
Oh, no, no.
No, don't. I would never compare Reese's to grapefruits. Reese's are amazing. Okay. The other thing I would want to know is the Reese's cup, classic, already everyone's favorite.
Yes.
But almost everyone I've ever talked to would also agree that the, like, if I were to say holiday shape Reese's are even better in most cases.
Even betterer.
Even
indeed.
Betterer.
Yes.
Okay.
No, if it is shaped like a pumpkin or a Christmas tree.
Or an Easter egg. Yeah.
It is a better Reese's cup.
Okay.
Like the ridges are what make Reese's iconic, and somehow they don't have to be there for it to be better.
Yeah. I don't know what they're doing to make the holiday shapes better, but it is.
Somehow I almost think the ridges are actually holding it back.
Do you know what the ridges actually, I think, look like?
What do they look like?
They look like what they are, Ben. And that's a crown.
A crown.
A crown.
Because it is king candy.
Because it is king candy.
Oh, man.
Now, okay. So I want to know from the people, and let us know on like Twitter or wherever, hashtag popcorn culture, what is the best holiday-shaped Reese's candy? Because, man, they're so good. They're so tasty.
I do have an answer to that question, but I don't want to say it.
Okay.
Because I don't want to influence.
You don't want to influence.
Yes.
So we'll come back to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so what's really fascinating to me about this graph is that that Reese's is the clear winner for perceived favorite and also actual favorite, but is what other candies are perceived as being the next best thing.
Yes.
But are actually not, which to me speaks to the extreme marketing of these candies. Like, you know? Like,
no, absolutely. Yeah. So as I'm looking at it here, like, so for example, Reese's highest perceived and most favorite in first place, but going down to fourth place is going to be Snickers, where you're going to have the second highest perceived favorite, but fourth in terms of
actual
favorite. And then plain M&M's being the third one, which I think is all the way down here at 10th place, third perceived highest favorite candy, 10th actual favorite candy.
Wow.
So I think that is definitely marketing. I do wonder how much influence we played in peanut M&M's coming in at the second mark.
I don't think we played any influence, Ben. Peanut M&M's are the best.
Okay, so how do you eat your peanut M&M's? Are you like an immediate cruncher? Do you ever sort of let the shell and chocolate like melt off in your mouth and then just like eat the peanut?
I'm a cruncher.
You're a cruncher.
I go straight through because I want the candy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the chocolate and the peanut all at once.
What's the best color?
They're all the same.
Dang it. I thought I was going to trick you.
No.
It seemed like you were going to say blue.
No. blue is the most, is the nicest looking one.
No, green.
No, Ben.
Green.
Blue, I think, is the newest color of M&M.
Is it, okay, I want to know, what is the most recently added new M&M color? Because as a child, and I have no idea if this is like Mandela effect, but I feel like I remember there being a period of time when we the people were voting for what new color was going to be added.
I think we were.
Because there was a dark brown and a light brown, and I think they were getting rid of the light brown M&M.
Right. Why do you need two browns?
I don't know. Chocolate is brown.
Chocolate is brown,
but
maybe.
One of them is not dark chocolate. It is just a dark-colored light chocolate candy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is accurate, and I think the replacement color was blue.
Hang on. What is the newest M&M color? Pink. No.
No, but that's not a, that's a, that doesn't come in a
in
yellow
a bag.
In a yellow, in a peanut M&M bag.
Hang on.
I mean, M&M's come in every color now.
Right. No,
if you,
yeah.
If you want,
like,
it bad enough.
Okay. At the M&M's Wikipedia article, if you search the word blue, it doesn't come up at all.
That is surprising.
There is no, hang on. Okay, maybe it's because there were categories that were closed. Okay, the original colors of the M&M candies were red, yellow, violet, green, and brown.
Violet. So they replaced that one.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see here. In 1976, Mars eliminated red-colored M&Ms because of health concerns over the dye Amaranth Red Number 2, which was a suspected carcinogen, and replaced them with orange M&Ms.
That is, they must have, obviously they've reintroduced red, because the red M&M is like the top spokesperson.
Like the mascot?
For M&Ms.
Okay. In early 1995, this is Welcome to Popcorn Culture, where Ben and Jay read from Wikipedia articles.
The year that Forrest Gump won the Oscar.
Unanimously agreed upon.
By everyone. Eating their M&Ms, apparently.
Right.
With blue, it sounds like. Maybe.
In early 1995, I was 6 years old. Ben Carlin, 6 years old. Mars ran a promotion in which consumers were invited to vote on which of blue, pink, or purple would replace the tan M&Ms. Blue was the winner with 54% of the votes.
Wow, so everyone agreed on a lot of stuff that year.
People did.
They were like, blue M&Ms, Forrest Gump.
No questions asked.
No questions asked. Let me tell you what else was no questions asked, Ben, was chocolate candy versus fruit candy.
Yes.
And I will say, let me double check it here. I want to say Skittles was high and away the favorite fruit candy, but by no means does fruit candy even hold a candle to chocolate candy.
Well, hold on. Are you overlooking Starburst at the number three spot, or is that not a number three spot based on
what?
My interpretation of this graph?
I don't know what chart you're looking at.
I don't know. Yeah.
What I'm looking at is just favorite candies ranked, where it goes Reese's, Peanut M&M's, Kit Kat, Snickers, Reese's Pieces, Milky Way, and then Skittles.
Milky Way?
Surprising to me, too.
Interesting.
And then how far down do we have to go from there before we get to another fruit candy? We have Toblerone, Twix, Play M&M's, Hershey's, which seems really high, Tootsie Rolls, Three Musketeers, and then Sour Patch Kids.
Okay, I have to say that Tootsie Rolls beating out Three Musketeers is more shocking to me than maybe some of the other data on here.
Tootsie Rolls isn't even chocolate.
It's not even chocolate.
It's like Yoo-Hoo.
Yeah.
It's like, this is chocolate drink.
It's chocolate drink. It's like, not made from chocolate.
Tootsie Rolls are chocolate flavored candy. Who would vote for Tootsie Rolls? Not me. No one's ever gone up to the counter at the movie theater and been like, hey, give me a bag of Tootsie Rolls. Not that I can think of.
Okay, Yoo-Hoo is an American brand of chocolate drink that was developed by Natalie Oliveri.
Uh-huh.
Probably. In New Jersey in 1928, it is manufactured by Keurig Dr. Pepper. As of 2019, the drink is primarily made from water, high fructose corn syrup, and whey. No chocolate. It is the Tootsie Roll of drinks.
It is the Tootsie Roll of drinks, and Tootsie Roll is the Yoo-Hoo of candy.
Oh my gosh.
Simultaneously.
Well, guys, thank you so much for tuning in, for giving us your feedback on all of your favorite candies. We asked you a question in this episode where we need feedback on it. I'm forgetting what that question was. Do you remember?
It was a long time ago, Ben. We asked people if they had ever had a fandom out, like introduced someone to a fandom and then been ousted from it by the inductee.
Inductee, yes. Okay. We need our own show notes for whilst we are recording these episodes.
Yeah, we should type stuff as we go.
We should, we should. I wonder if the typing would be audible to the microphones.
It might be a little.
Yeah, well, anyway. So yes, what we need to know, you can let us know at popcornculturepod@gmail.com whether or not you have ever introduced one of your friends to a new thing and their fandom or interest in that thing ultimately outweighed yours, or vice versa, if you basically, you know, had so much more interest in something than someone else that it diminished their own interest, like what happened with Alice and I over Harry Potter. Yeah, so be sure to send us those emails, tell us your stories, and otherwise, thank you guys so much for tuning into this episode of The Pop.
And for agreeing that grapefruits are terrible.
Until next time.
Bye.
Pop, pop.